Blog Talk Radio.
Live because we want to stay alive. And Torah Chaim, instructions are alive. Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness. Torah Rachmim, instructions of mercies. And hopefully we won't let you down on today's show. That was actually a song that was written by Ziggy Marley. I have live on the line. We have co-host Ron Williams, Noah Hyde, student, activist, scholar, advocate, and advocate for the dissemination of the seven Noahic commandments. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Don. How are you?
Well, battling a midsummer cold kind of took me by surprise, and I won't tell no lies. I'm not feeling so great, but I know I have a better fate if I'm on live with you to share with the blessed souls who are listening, or will be listening in the archive version of Soul Class Number 87, teachings designed to reveal heaven on earth. Not that, you know, we're going to talk about some sort of ethereal conceptualizations. And just to remind everyone that SOUL is an acronym for S7O, this is the original U, universal L laws, seven axiomatic commandments, which boil down in a very superficial way but need very in-depth study to understand all the implications and the applications on this for the blessed human family. Number one, not to blaspheme the Creator with the Creator's name. Number two, not to commit idolatry. Number three, not to commit premeditated acts of murder. Number four, not to commit acts of adultery. Number five, not to steal. Number six, not to eat the limb of an animal while still alive. Number seven, there is a righteous statutes in each land according to the divine plan to promote healthy lifestyles for each and every one in a pleasant and peaceful manner, and to get society in order, prepare all of us for the imminent revelation of Mashiach Tzidkenu, our righteous Messiah. Ron, I just said a mouthful, but I want to ask you, excuse me, there's that summer cold I'm talking about. You know, before the show, we talked a little about this song, Won't Let You Down by Ziggy Marley, and Ziggy Marley came up with a very I would say, a very intimate, focused presentation of the last words, what his father told him. Of course, the great reggae singer Bob Marley, who told him when he goes up, when Ziggy ascends in his life mission, that he'll take his father up. And if he goes down, he won't be alone because his father will go with him. And you had a very interesting perspective on it. I was wondering if you could share with our blessed listeners, what is your perspective on those lyrics and the implications in everyday life for those of us who are looking to look more into the deeper dimensions of life?
Well, there's a teaching. I, honestly speaking, cannot remember exactly where I read this teaching. But it says that if a man is righteous and his son walks in the righteous path, he is termed righteous.
Mm-hmm.
But if his son walks in the wrong path and perpetrates acts of wickedness into the world, he is also termed wicked. And it said that if a man has not walked in the right path, but his son chooses to walk in the correct path, then the father is also termed righteous. So from that teaching, it appears to be as if your offspring actually determine your standing in terms of being righteous or wicked.
Right.
So that's what I wanted to bring concerning that the lyrics in that song.
And I'd like to give two examples from the opposite extremes, how both of their descendants were righteous, despite the actions of their ancestors, or actions weren't so righteous. But let's also bring in now our other co-host, Dennis Ryan, our advocate, student, and teacher of Rabbi Moses Ben Maimon, Maimonides, from his epic work, The Guide to Perplexed. Dennis, can you help us get a little unperplexed and give us a shout-out today? And I just want to let you know I'm kind of battling with a summer cold, so if I cough a little bit, you'll excuse me.
Don, cough all you want, as long as it's a righteous cough.
Okay, hopefully I'll cough out the negative stuff for me. Anyway, so gentlemen and anyone listening in, that there are two people who had righteous ancestors, and it might surprise people to know that Korach, who was, we talked a couple of portions ago in the Torah, in the book of Numbers, rebelled against the leadership of Moses, and basically he predicated his, so to speak, insurrection against the mighty Levite prophet, who was actually his cousin, so in a sense it was a family feud as well as a insurrection, rebellion against Hashem, the Most High, because he saw with divine inspiration that Samuel the prophet, Shmuel HaNavi, would actually descend from his loins as a great descendant of his. And so he thought that he would defeat Moses, but he only saw a certain level of Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration. Well, Moses saw what Korach saw, but saw beyond, that what needed to be was set up the structure of the nation of Israel at that time, was that his brother, Aaron, was the high priest and he was the leader. And Korach felt slighted that he wasn't given the honor that, say, Moses and Aaron were, based on the whole conception that the whole nation was holy and dedicated to the service of Hashem. Although you can read about in the written and oral traditions of the Torah that there were many slippages and mistakes and sometimes outright rebellions against Moshe, Moses, and the Most High. Another example of that was actually Haman, who read about in the book of Esther, who actually in one day tried to annihilate all of the nation of Israel, the Jewish people. But yet the Talmud says that although 10 of his sons were hung, that he still had descendants around. Either he had another, I'm not sure he had another son, but he had grandchildren at that point, if he had 10 sons. And from those sons and the descendants of those grandchildren, they actually they converted and became Jews and went to learn Torah in a place called Bnei Brak, which exists to this day. So we see that the best intentions of people seeking to hurt the nation of Israel, or people in general, that despite their misconceptions or distorted awareness, that emanating from their loins can be very righteous people. And I think we've talked about it on this show. If we haven't talked about it on this show live, let's talk about it now. That anyone who is living today on this planet had to have ancestors that were pretty righteous, that to this generation there is an extension of them. So even if we say in the most opposite, the greatest extreme, say someone like Haman or Haman, who was definitely a wicked man, who Mamash tried to accomplish something that, the paradox is he tried to accomplish something even Hitler didn't even dream of, although Hitler was more successful in trying to annihilate us and all those who were not of the quote-unquote Aryan superior race, which is a fictitious type of depiction. There's no such thing as a superior race, because in Torah there's not even a word for race. It's either nation or families, cousins, mothers, fathers. The Torah doesn't talk in terms of race, because if we call ourselves a race, then we think there's a finish line. But in the Most High's road, there is no finish line. There's the continuous ascension into the road of eternity. I know, gentlemen, I'm kind of hogging up the space here. I hope you don't mind. Just that I wanted to share that with everyone. And it's interesting. As I talk this, I feel less the desire to cough. Dennis, let me ask you this. In your upbringing or your life experiences, have you seen, in fact, where the child, the descendant of the previous generation, can give not only joy to the parent, but actually can give them more of a reason for staying in this world, and actually make them feel healthier and wealthier? Because if you're healthy, you're wealthy. Dennis, we'd like to elaborate on this concept.
Well, we, from generation to generation, humans are a little strange, because they normally, the children, sort of don't reject what their parents were doing, but they want to do it in their way, or what they conceive as a new way, because they don't want to listen to the old people per se. That is, until they become old. So we have a circle here of human behavior that says that the children want to do it their way, but what do they end up doing? They only revert back to what their parents were doing anyway, because life is not that creative. How many different things can you think to survive as a human that your parents haven't already done? You're not going to invent a new way. We have fear, but the humans have fear of the unknown, like a nuclear war or any other thing like that. We even have people who are in fear of Jewish people, even their heritage. The fear, we don't know what the fear is. Based on what is transcribed on the program today, maybe they're in fear of righteous people. I don't know. But the problem is that that sticks in their minds. Supposed to have faith and being content, so that way they can follow the previous generations. So we have a human problem here that keeps changing, but as it changes, it goes back to the original thing. It's stuck in a human circle here, and humans don't really learn from history that much, no matter how we try to remind them. People still make the same mistakes, are still distracted, and don't bother to get the facts.
Very good point, Dennis. And I think also, too, that in this process that people are not learning the history, at a certain level we are, but I think there's a process where, you know, it stays in the head, but it doesn't penetrate the heart. And I admit this is also something I must deal with as a human being. And I see sometimes in my discussions, and you talked about some people have a certain fear of the Jewish people. I have to admit, as a Jewish person, and one of my toughest struggles to engage other Jewish people in a path that I didn't invent. Actually, this is something that Rambam talked about, that the Jewish people should share these seven Noahic commandments and have what I would consider to be intimate discussions about our similarities and our differences, which we'll be learning hopefully today and in other programs. But Jewish people are still suffering from almost 2,000 years of an exile mentality, because unfortunately leaving our land had a very severe traumatic effect upon us. Now, at the same time, too, unfortunately, you have Jewish people who think that the solution to all of our problems is that all of us just move back to Israel today, this moment, which I would love to do. However, I was instructed by a direct descendant of King David and Solomon, the Baba Tzurabi, said that that is not necessarily going to bring about the salvation of the Jewish people if we just all pack up our bags and declare ourselves to be Zionists. True, we are trying to be Torah observant Jews, and each one according to his own level, because even people that do not even Noahites that don't claim themselves to be observant of the seven Noahide commandments, most of them, most of us, are not transgressing. Like, most people are not going to commit, thank God, premeditated murder. Most people try to avoid, I would say most people try to avoid stealing, because if there were the majority of people were stealing, I think we would have seen such chaos in society and on the levels that, unfortunately, we would have direct comparisons to Sodom and Gomorrah. But we see the laws in each land are generally predicated on protection of personal property and personal rights of property and personal ownership. I mean, just because I buy a car, that doesn't entitle you as my next-door neighbor to take it out, and if it gets crashed, I have to pay the increased insurance rate. No. There are ramifications for our actions. So with that being said, Ron, I'd like to turn to you. And, you know, what is your take on, for instance, this idea that, and this could be a tough question, but don't be afraid to answer, why do you think Jewish people are sort of like a little bit intimidated or a little timid in terms of trying to dialogue in a very humble way that I've been doing for the last 14 years, basically based on the instructions of Rambam and the Lubavitcher Rebbe? And why Noahides are still resistant to the idea that the Jewish people have been privy to a plan which was really given to non-Jews or Noahides before our time. Why is this trepid? Why is there fear on both sides of the same coin? I mean, we're basically two sides, we're different sides of the same coin created by the Creator, originating in the original coin, original man, Adam Arishon.
Okay. You're right when you said it's a tough question for you to answer, but I would like to try to answer from both perspectives. First of all, from the we are not very well versed in the history of the Israelite nations when they had built under King Solomon's leadership, they had built the temple. Because if we were, we'd realize that a lot of Noahites, non-Jewish nations, actually came and worshipped at the temple. If we were privy to that information, then we would realize that this separation that we have here now is actually because of certain mandates throughout history that caused it. It's not an original separation like what we have today. The time of the temple, non-Jews were brought burnt offerings to the temple. It was accepted by the Kohanim, the high priest, and it was offered on their behalf to the Most High.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that King Solomon had married so many wives, people feel it was just for the sake of having wives, or he had a lot of, you know, women surrounding him. It was because King Solomon also felt that the laws that God gave for the entire universe can be dispersed through these different representatives from every nation that came. And as taking them on as wives, a lot of these women accepted the Torah and the Torah laws. And we know that Queen Sheba took it back with her to Ethiopia. And you know, throughout history, after they were taken away into exile to Rome and Greece and the other countries, these countries made specific laws that Jews are not allowed to teach or spread their religion. They're not really their way of life or the mandate that was entrusted to them by God to the other nations. As a result, they could not, and out of course, fear of being killed mercilessly at the hands of the Romans or the Greeks, they didn't. And throughout history, it continued that way. But nevertheless, a lot of Roman citizens and Greeks, they were termed as God-fearers and fearers of the one God.
Uh-huh.
They were actually Noahite. They were actually serving the one true God, creator of the universe. But we're not familiar with this information. The problem is after, of course, the unforgivable act, the Holocaust, that also threw us back a little bit and caused that further separation. That in modern times, you know, people could have enacted such atrocities against another nation. Actually, a nation living in their own country, citizens of their own country, of course, was a massive amount of trauma. So I'm a little lenient because of the way a lot of my, you know, Jews behave now, because I know it's coming from fears that who knows what can happen next. As what Dennis Ryan said, fear of the unknown. We don't know what can happen. Chas v'shalom, I mean, God forbid, anything, any of those type of actions should be, take place today. So I found myself being a lot more lenient, open, and a lot of times I initiate the conversation with you know, Jewish people when we meet and for whatever reason or another. And at that point, I get a very pleasant response, and the lines of communication just opens and there's a flow. So I just feel that many times I think now, due to the fact that non-Jews have caused this separation, not us particularly, but from coming from our side through history, we should now take the initiative of, you know, opening the door to communication. So I feel that that burden is kind of on us now to show we're willing to learn. We want to learn what you've been given for us by the Creator. We would like to know what that is, and we're ready to receive it.
True. Now, I just want to mention that I didn't mean to judge anyone for their feeling intimidated, whether it be Jewish people or children of Nahal, which is all the inhabitants of the world. It's just that, you know, there has been a misrepresentation of the role of human beings throughout history, unfortunately, by those who felt that it's better to have a short-term accomplishment at the expense of a long-time, long-time, I don't know if that's the right word, a larger, more broader perspective, you know, towards the establishment of the kingdom of heaven on earth. I mean, it sometimes, unfortunately, the strivings of man seem to go in the opposite direction to Hashem's plan, the Most High's plan. But anyway, gentlemen, let's go on.
Don?
Yes, Dennis.
Let me just throw a couple of pennies into the pot here. I think people today have a certain apprehension. It's not a complete fear. They're not against God. They're not against religion. But they have a certain amount of questions in the back of their head regarding organized religion. And organized religion sometimes is becoming more important than the product that they're involved in. And that sometimes turns people off, or they feel that they really are not 100% or a part of it. In other words, they can say, well, I believe this, yes, and that, but the other things, well, they're questionable. This over here, no, I'm not for that at all. So it isn't so much it's a laundry list. It's just that organized religion is not emphasizing, let's say, the same things we're talking about here on the radio, because there's always a fear. And the one thing that always struck me funny about reading old Jewish scripts was one that why some people rejected Jesus Christ after he died. And that was Jesus of Nazareth. And that was, well, if he was really king, how come he didn't come back and show us that we're the chosen ones and give us everything we were promised, and why weren't we elevated? He came and went, and he didn't change Israel at all. All he did was say some nice statements, promise things, and told you to believe. So we have this thing here as to why people have questions in the back of their head. I don't know if we'll ever solve them, certainly not today in the radio, but people are apprehensive, and we just have to smile and be positive, just like Ron said. Rather than trying to say, here, you belong here, it's easy to say, why don't you try this?
Right, right. I hear you. Okay, gentlemen, now let's move on to the next section. We've been talking about the 48 ways that one can acquire Torah and the two attributes we'd like to focus on this week. And I'm going to be drawing myself from the Torah anthology and some teachings of Rabbi Nachman. And I also asked Dennis and Ron to do a little homework, which actually they had 2 weeks to do. So hopefully, gentlemen, you have something to share with us. And so the fifth attribute which one can implement into their acquisition of Torah, meaning make it a part of yourself and your lifestyle, is the concept of Ema, which literally translated from the Hebrew means dread. And the way it's explained in the Maam Loez is that a student should be in a certain dread of his teacher, meaning not that a person should dread a teacher as if the teacher is bigger, you know, as if the tree is not the forest, but meaning a person, if a person is going to seriously learn Torah, they should be extremely attentive, and they dread not to wander off into their own thoughts while the teacher is giving over a particularly salient teaching, which is he worked on, he toiled in to bring it down to the level of the student, not for that student, for other students. And also that the student should not be screaming out at the teacher. There's another perspective of dread is that the sages, which is brought down in the Talmudic tractate of Kiddushin. And let me just see here. I just had the page, which anyone wants to see themselves, because you can see all these things now in the Talmudic translations into English. That let's see here. Let's just pull it out here. Yeah, in the Talmudic tractate of Kiddushin, the 20th page, section B. That the sages used to actually put a scarf upon their head from the dread of the Shekhinah. Now, this is something that is at this point now is rabbinically obligatory on a Jewish man. The reasoning is that we don't. When I wear a yarmulke or a kippah, I wear a cap on my head or a hat on Shabbat. I don't wear it just to try to stay in trendy style with the rest of my Jewish brothers, but actually I'm acknowledging that the sum total of all consciousness doesn't stop at the apex of my head. I mean, that area above my brain or my skull and the hairs emanating out of the back of my head or the front of the head or the side of my head, there's actually a higher awareness, and that awareness is the divine presence. And this whole idea of putting a sudar, which is a scarf, is connected to a verse in Psalms which said, Sod Hashem L'Yireyov, that the secrets of Hashem are for those who fear Him. That a person who is engaged in Torah and wants to cling to the Shekhinah, meaning that higher level of consciousness, should be one who should see no problem in publicly testifying that there's a higher consciousness than everything that's reverberating and vibrating in between his left ear and his right ear. So let's go around the table, gentlemen. Dennis, did you see anything in God to the Perplexed, your own taking this whole idea of the attribute of dread that a person should feel in order to make an acquisition on divine instruction?
Well, I went through word by word through the Guide to the Perplexed, and there were 6 times that the word dread was used. And it's usually dread. It's usually used with the word dread and fear. So we have 6 particular situations here, and I can go through them if you want me to, or do you just want me to gloss over and summarize them?
Dennis, the floor is yours. The table is served with all the delights for other people to imbibe in. If you will read us those delights.
All right, so here we go with the first one. It's regarding the secrets of the law. This is an example. It's taken out page 48 of the Guide to the Perplexed, in whom wisdom is united with humility, meekness, and a great dread of sin. So in effect, he's using the word dread as it relates to sin. That's on a simple one. Next, we go to using the name of God. the sacred name, which, as you know, is not pronounced except in the sanctuary by the appointed priest. When they gave the sacerdotal blessing, and by the high priest of the day, on the Day of Atonement, undoubtedly denotes something which is particular to God and is not found in any other being. It is possible that the Hebrew language, of which we have but a slight knowledge, the Tetragrammaton, is in the way it was pronounced, conveyed the meaning of absolute existence. In short, the majesty of the name and the great dread of uttering it are connected with the fact that it denotes God himself. Right?
Mm-hmm.
The next excerpt is from Faith Through Knowledge. One second.
Good.
All this is given, this is page 313 of the Guide to Perplex. All this is given in the form of final results. But they cannot be fully understood and accurately accept alter the acquisition of many kinds of knowledge. Scripture further demands belief in certain truths, the belief in which is indispensable in regulating our social relations. Such is the belief of God is angry with those who disobey him, for it leads us to the fear and dread of disobedience to the will of God. The next one is on page 336, and that involves idolatry and false witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
We must also point out that the originators of false, baseless, and useless principles scheme and plan for the firm establishment of their faith and tell their fellow men that a certain plague will befall those who will not perform the act in which that faith is supported and confirmed forever. This plague may one day accidentally befall a person who will then direct his attention to the performance of that act and adopt idolatry.
Mm-hmm. Is that the complete presentation?
What?
Is there something else to read?
Yeah. There's just two quick more on 346.
Okay.
Hang on. Page 346, secondly, changing an animal devoted to the sanctuary for another from Levi. Because this change leads to condemning sacrifices devoted to the name of God. Thirdly, cursing by a person by the name of God, mainly the name of God, because many dread the effect of the curse more than the bodily harm. And the last one involves circumcision, believe it or not. And it says, secondly, the young child has not much pain, because the skin is tender and the imagination weak. A grown-up person's are in dread and fear of things which they imagine are coming sometime before they actually occur.
Mm-hmm.
So that covers the use of the word dread in the Guide to the Perplexed.
Very nice. And I just want to mention to everyone listening in that in no way is that a contradiction to what I had mentioned, because Torah is endless and we don't look at the combination of any Hebrew letters, or as the Hebrew letters are translated into any other language among the living peoples of this world, as cement block definitions that you'd say find in Webster's dictionary. The fact that that Hebrew letters, which are a reflection of the divine speech of the Most High, mean that there are many things that can be excavated from within those teachings. And Dennis, by that presentation he gave, and thank you for that, Dennis, that you can come out with explanation after explanation. Now, not everyone can process all the explanations, but to know that there is a great diversity in terms of the understanding of the concept of fear. Now, we'd like to go to Ron. Ron, we'd like to chip in on this concept of fear from anything you've learned in the last 2 weeks. I should say dread. Actually, dread.
Okay. I'm actually using the word fear because I think one of the reasons I feel is that people are more they encounter fear sometimes in a more general perspective than dread.
Right.
And one thing I wanted to point out to you is that the word yarmulke, which is the head covering that the modern-day Jewish person wears, came from the Aramaic word, which means the word in Hebrew for fear is yira,
mm-hmm.
and the word for king is malak, melek, yeah? And if you put the two together in Aramaic, it comes out to yeri malak, fear of the king. Modern-day terminology, yarmulke. So keeping the head covered with a yarmulke signifies the fact that the person is fear of what's above.
I just want to mention that there is no obligation for a son of Noah to cover their head, but in fact their fear of the king is through the application and the observance of the seven Noahic commandments. Am I not correct on that, Ron?
Yes, that's true. That's correct.
That's the Yarmulke. That's their expression of the fear of the king. Well, before I get to you further, Ron, and I think it's important since you're quoting from that valuable book that you have there, can you tell people the name of the book and the publisher? So if people want to get the book themselves, they can do so, say, like on eBay or any of the big bookstores or anywhere on the Internet.
This is The Guide for the Perplexed by Moses Maimonides. It's Dover Publications. It's not that expensive. And the translator is Michael Freelander, who is esteemed as a translator. And a lot of people have gone over his translation and said, well, he has the best translation because he remains neutral as he translated, which is very, very important. So it's The Guide to the Perplexed by Moses Maimonides, and it's Dover Publications.
Dover, like Dover, New Jersey, Dover, Delaware. Very nice. Okay, I'm back to you. You wanted to further elaborate?
Okay. I have in front of me the Prayer Blessing Principles of Faith and Divine Service for Noahites, published by Rabbi Moshe Wiener and Rabbi J. Emanuel Shochet. And it says, serving God with one's mind and heart. It says that, what is the love and fear that a person should have for the Creator? It says that when a person understands that God is the creator of everything and keeps everything in existence every moment, and that God created all people so that they should honor and serve Him, and then he meditates on the infinite greatness of the Creator according to his ability, he will come to love God. And when one contemplates on the lowliness of any creation in comparison to the creator of everything, he will realize God's infinite greatness, and awe and fear of God will fall upon him. A person will also be humbled by knowing that he's small, lowly, with a severe limited understanding, who is standing in the presence of God. And I just wanted connect these two together, fear and humility, that many times fear can lead to humility, especially when dealing with the service of the Creator, and that fear is actually necessary for us to repel that which is forbidden by the Creator.
Excuse me.
Yeah, okay, done. So, that's basically what I wanted to bring out on fear.
Okay, very good. So let's go into fear now, which is the sixth attribute. Now, kind of brings together in a roundabout way the things that we've talked about, gentlemen, is that the idea of yira is actually now fear, F-E-A-R, is that when a person learns Torah, that a person should have a sense of fear of heaven, which is meaning of the Creator. That's a, should we say, like a euphemism for referring to the Most High. As it says that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Most High. That Torah is not likened to other wisdoms. For instance, the wisdoms of the sciences of engineering, and astrological teachings, mathematics. Because any person, according to their individual composition, can learn whatever they want in this world, even if their conduct is not becoming of themselves as a human being. However, the wisdom of a Torah, the Holy Torah, is not something that's going to enter into the body of someone who is engaged in negative behaviors. Meaning, Torah, of course, when you're learning Torah, a person cannot be at the best state of consciousness or actions, behaviorally. That the Torah will not be internalized by someone who learns it. In fact, there's a teaching from the Talmudic tractate of Yoma that for some people, Torah is an elixir of life. But for others, it's actually a poison because it actually, so to speak, is used in a negative way by the person for self-aggrandizement, to feed their ego, to know that they could be over other people. And actually, they will be taken account of, that they will have to give an accounting, I should say, for why they acted in such a grandiose manner because they were privy to divine instruction. With that being said, that if a person can integrate what I just mentioned before, the fifth characteristic of dread, which is relating on a more personal level, again, within the context of this teaching of the Mayim Loaz, the Torah anthology, the fear of the teacher, in the way only that is permissible for a person to fear his teacher, and in a way that a person is expected to have fear of the Most High, which means they should not want to transgress the teachings of the Most High. From there, a person also can come to love the Most High and love the Torah teachings. And also, there's another teaching that where there is no fear of the Most High, there's no wisdom of the Most High. And if a person accustoms their teachings, accustoms their mouth to repeat the teachings of their teachers, and they engage in the totality of wisdom and returning to the Most High through actions, good actions, that therefore a person should be readily assured that they are probably not going to fall out on the side of those who are rebelling against the Most High, but actually who are students of the Most High. With that being said, gentlemen, I'd like to pull out from some wonderful teachings that many people have maybe heard of via other people, or they've encountered perhaps a pamphlet which sometimes can be found in Jewish neighborhoods, teachings by Rabbi Nachman. And Rabbi Nachman was known to be a tremendous righteous human being who lived over 200 years ago, and I think he passed away in 1810 before he went to the next level of life. And he talked about, I'm going to just say succinctly what he talked about, this whole idea of dread and fear. So the thing to know, blessed souls, is that the way he would address the people, that he would say, "You should know, my beloved one, my son, that a fear, that a dread that a person should have from another, is so to speak like the fear that would come upon the sota, the woman who unfortunately was warned by her husband in Israelite society." Not to seclude herself with a man under the suspicion that perhaps she, you know, that she would be led into an adulterous relationship, which is a big no-no in our culture. So the idea of dread is that a person would fear just the water, not even shown to the woman. The woman wasn't even forced yet to drink what was called the mei sota, the testing waters of the sota. That she would just see it, and this will put dread upon her to confess either that she did engage in an adulterous relationship, or that her fear would compel her otherwise to actually be willing to accept to drink the waters to prove her innocence. So when a person wants to have the merit to learn and to acquire the Torah, that a person should see as if basically that one is standing in front of him, and who would that person be standing in front of him? His teacher. So when one utters a teaching, for instance, I mean, even though we don't really have a real picture, although there's a popular picture of Rambam, we can't really say for certain that that's what he looked like. And when one is learning a teaching, say God the Perplexed or the Mishnah Torah, one should picture as if the Rambam himself was watching how we would deliver over a teaching from him. And as well, when a person conducts himself in a certain manner that it becomes customary in their conduct, they're going to see that they're going to get a great arousal in their soul. They're going to experience what is known as the Rishpe Eish Shalahavet Yudke, a flaming fire from the first two letters of the divine name of the Most High, that basically I've seen in other places in the teachings of Chassid, not necessarily from Rabbi Nachman, that this concept of Shalhevet Yudke, the Yud and the He, is basically a fire that burns in the soul of the human being and its desire to cling to the Most High. And when we, in our revealed consciousness, can connect to that level of Torah in that manner, that for sure we're going to learn the Torah with a certain dread and acquire it in that fashion, but we're going to experience a higher connection with the Most High. Now, when it comes to fear, Rabbi Nachman says again, my beloved, my son, that it's not possible to have the merit to require Torah except by when a person has a certain fear. When a person has a certain fear, and again, dread of the Most High, and continually he forms before the eyes of his intellect that the whole world is filled with his glory, that he fills all the worlds, the Most High does, with his glory, and he encompasses all the worlds with all his glory, and he penetrates all the worlds with his glory, and within this glory he has given the divine instruction, which we know as the Torah. So therefore a person should fall into a great fear, that he should only have a fear from the Most High. Now it's not really that a person is coming into contradiction or direct opposition to, we mentioned how a person should have of a dread of a teacher, because we're talking about two different levels. You know, these type of teachings, I can only say, gentlemen, if I'm not presenting it in a clear fashion, is because that each person who is now, whoever's listening, and ourselves as we go into these teachings, are discussing these matters, is basically a person has to sit down and get into a quiet state of mind and to interact with these teachings, as Dennis read those several pages, as Ron gave his perspectives, his consciousness on the matter. But the truth of the matter is that we can say these teachings very flippantly and very superficially, but when a person takes time to really slow down in their thinking process of what's going on here, is that we're engaging in levels of making sure that our connection with the Most High is one that will not be broken, can't be broken, and actually one of growth. Gentlemen, we have about 11 minutes to go. We have to start getting some verses from Genesis, but if either one of you want to chime in for a minute or so. Ron, would you like to comment on what I just mentioned?
It's funny that you said that about the ending there, because I have open in front of me the Perkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, by Breslov. And Rabbi Nachman said that the only reason why people are so far from God is because they lack a calm, focused mind. The spiritual perfection of the world depends entirely on this. From his Likuti Moran, his the source of his work, basically. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to say that it does require a certain quietness, and unfortunately, it's something right now that is sought after the most, because you know we're just at such a high speed all the time. We have to really sit back and allow ourselves to focus and meditate on certain teachings, to really understand it and internalize it.
Yes. Dennis, you want to chime in before we go on to start to look into verses from the Genesis?
All right. Let me just mention, yes, in everybody there's an inherent question mark. What is God? Where is God? Who is God? And we have consciences that keep bringing that back to us. So yes, we all have a burning desire to learn a little bit more than we do know about God. No doubt about it. But I would like to mention one thing regarding the yarmulke that you mentioned before, and that is we've always treated a head covering as a respect for the Almighty. Religions do it, but they do it more formally than regular people. However, all the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, a bishop, a cardinal, and the Pope, all wear yarmulkes, and they have to wear yarmulkes because it's prescribed. So we even have in the Hindu the Sikh religion that says once you become of age, you must have your head covered at all times. And they believe that absolutely. So there is a general need from a human viewpoint to show respect for the Lord, and head covering has always been one of them.
Beautiful. Okay, gentlemen, now we've got about 9 minutes to go, plus I want to play a little piece, hopefully music that will encourage people to get in a peaceful state of mind, music that's found off the website of Laser Brody from Amuna Films, but we'll get to that in about 10 minutes. So chapter 1, verse 23, we're going to see the conclusion of the fifth day. Chapter 1, verse 23, and there was evening and there was morning the fifth day. What I just want to bring out, instead of reviewing what happened on the fifth day, which one can read about in verses 20 through 22, in chapter 1, is that note that it says there was evening and there was morning a fifth day, which is the Torah testifying, gentlemen, and those who are listening, that according to the Torah perspective, a day starts by night, and the morning, which we call day, is actually the second part of that day. Okay, now let's go into chapter 1, verse 24, and we see that the Most High spoke, and he says the following. Chapter 1, verse 24, God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures, each according to its kind, animal and creeping thing, and beast of the land, each according to its kind." And it was so. And then chapter 1, verse 25, God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, and the animal according to its kind, and every creeping being of the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Gentlemen, we see here that already in the fifth day that creatures were brought out, and they were teeming and flourishing, and then the great sea monsters were brought out, as well as the other varieties of fish. Now we're talking about the creatures of the land. Now, there's a very interesting teaching by the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe, said that whatever you see in the ocean, which it's hard to see unless you go down in there, or you go fishing, or you put on your scuba gear, and in fact, there's a corresponding creature to it on the land. Except with one exception, I think it's the chulda, the weasel. There's no such thing as a sea weasel, though there might be a fish or an aquatic animal which seems to replicate it, but basically the weasel, which is a land animal, is one of the few things that is the one particular thing that does not exist in the sea. And of course, man does not live in the ocean, and the only thing that would approximate a man is, I think, a type of jellyfish which is called man-o-war, but no one would be confuse a man for a jellyfish, although some people have unfortunately in their conduct, they have more of a sting than most jellyfish. Dennis or Ron, would you like to make any comments on these two verses? On the first of all, that the Most High spoke about it. It was important enough for the Creator to speak about the bringing forth of animal life upon the face of this living earth.
Well, Dennis, I would think when we talk about flora and fauna, there's no doubt about it that the Almighty created a complete environment for humans on the earth. And you got to remember that most of the earth is covered by water as compared to land. And certainly you'd want to have a representation in the water as well as on the land. So I always go back to some descriptions by, who's it, Philo or Philo? He was a Jewish theologian in the 3rd and 4th century, as well as Augustine of Hippo. And they sort of didn't take exception with Genesis. They just said it was worded so that people could understand it, because most of the people that were trying to learn this were not really educated. So it had to be explained to them in a more poetic fashion than actuality. So I sort of subscribe to that, and I still think that the story of Genesis is a nice story. But to me, it is a story, a blessed story at that.
Okay. Ron, would you like, before I comment, would you like to say anything about these two verses?
For me, basically, as I'm listening, I see one thing that it, when God said, and it came to be, and it was so. We see that this was a desire, a revelation of God's desire, that He wanted these things here. So He said it; it was so. And it says at the end of it, and God saw it was good. So we should always keep in mind, whenever we, all of our acts here in this world should also follow in that same way, in which what we say we should. Make sure that it is good, because when we reveal our thoughts through our words and our actions, they should all be good.
Amen. I just want to mention, Dennis, that I've seen explanations from the sage of Israel that the depiction of the story, yes, they are a story, but we have to remember that Torah is an expression of hara, of instruction, meaning there is a certain instruction that we don't get all the details of the creation in the first 6 and first 7 days of creation, because the rest was basically left upon the children of man to discover the wonders of this creation, to see the nuances between species and species, and hopefully to recognize that in the nuances between species and species, we actually come to avoid mixing the species and understand that everything has a certain place in this blessed creation. Well, gentlemen, that's going to wrap up the show today. I'd like to thank Dennis Ryan, our promoter and teacher, advocate for the God's Perplexed. Thank you very much, Dennis, for joining us today. And also Rana Williams, our Noah Heights scholar, activist, teacher, good friend, and all right, good guy. And by the way, that also makes Dennis my good friend and good guy as well. And this is your humble Torah activist, cyberspace, how should we say, sharer, Donzos Yeguman. Gentlemen, I'm going to play some music now. It's called Lachish Spring in Springtime, Lachish River in Springtime. Here comes my cold. And this is peaceful, relaxing music, unlike my cold. I wish everyone a great week, and let's hopefully join together next week when we're going to have to stop. We'll have to talk about, hopefully, with the Most High's blessings, about
love,
the race
peace,
of mankind. Okay, take care, Jim.
Recovery then. Shalom.
Thursday.